Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So yesterday, June 4th, marked the 23rd anniversary of the Tiananmen Square uprising in China. There was a candlelight vigil in Hong Kong, and the Shanghai stock market ended 64, that's 6-4, like June 4th, points down. But web searches about that news were blocked in China. China is a prime example of a repressive regime that is adapting to the 21st century. According to my next guest, William Dobson, the politics and foreign affairs editor at Slate and the author now of The Dictator's Learning Curve, Inside the Global Battle for Democracy, dictators all over the world are adapting to technology and other changing conditions. William Dobson, thanks for coming on. Congratulations on a fascinating book. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you very much for having me.
So did you go traveling around the world to dictatorships?
I did. About 2 years ago, I set out and I traveled to a number of different regimes. And in particular, I was focusing on regimes that I think are truly sort of the most sophisticated in their forms of repression. The regimes that have really been able to not just survive, but in some instances thrive in a world that is, frankly, much harder for dictatorships to exist in. So if you are able to sort of weather these forces and you are still there at it, you're doing something right. And I wanted to look at what it was they do, what is the architecture of authoritarianism for them. And so I traveled to Russia, China, Venezuela, Egypt, and Malaysia, among other places.
Dictator is kind of a tricky word. We tend to think of one strong man, the Gaddafi, Saddam Hussein model, but you also apply it to China.
That's right. And you're absolutely right. It's a broad umbrella. I mean, these are very different regimes. And they also have varying different capacities and areas of expertise. I mean, in the case of China, you mentioned it in the lead-in here, you know, 1989, if we were to go back in time then, none of us would really have imagined that more than 20 years later, a regime that was really on the edge, on the brink with Tiananmen Square and the collapse of the Soviet Union, which happened shortly thereafter, would be stronger than it's ever been, would really be enjoying its strongest chapter in its history. But that is indeed the case because the regime really, it didn't make the mistakes that so many others did. It didn't turn inward. What it did is it actually sent out researchers to the failed Soviet regimes, and it studied what they did wrong. It looked at examples of other regimes that have failed and took those lessons and brought them back and applied them. And so we think a lot of times of China, we think, well, it's succeeding because of its blistering economic growth. And that's true, and that's a very important part of the reforms. But there's a political component to that as well, and that often gets missed.
So I'm sure you weren't setting out to write a guide for dictatorships on how to survive in the 21st century. But what, for example, do you think China learned by studying the Soviet Union, and how did they do things differently?
Well, I mean, they learned that the government itself had become very removed from the people, that the machinery of the state had become ossified and was never very nimble. It fell back into becoming even more ideological and more rigid as it face challenges. And so what we see is a China that there's no question that China is not a free place, but it is far freer than it ever was. The regime has much less interest now in people's personal lives. Back then, there were always campaigns about your socialist purity. The regime doesn't care. It struck a different bargain with its people, which basically says, look, we'll get out of your life. We'll get out of your way. We'll even let you prosper. But in exchange, you will not show interest in the monopoly of the Chinese Communist Party. You will not show interest in politics. And if this kind of bargain can be struck, then we can all get along.
That answer makes me wonder, are countries either dictatorships or not? Because you seem to paint a kind of gray area with China.
No, that's right. I mean, they exist in the gray. There's no question about it. I mean, it's the case. I mean, take for example Russia. If we were to look at Russia's constitution, we would say, you know what? I see all the rights and freedoms that are protected in most democracies. That was the case when Putin came to power, but he didn't try to rip up the Constitution. He didn't rewrite it in a way that would sort of cement his powers. He rather worked through democratic means in order to solidify and centralize control in what is really just a handful of people. And so in fact, it's very important for these regimes that are the most sophisticated to speak in the language of democracy, mm-hmm. to work through democratic institutions and mechanisms in order to maintain that control.
So does that make Putin a dictator or a successful small-D Democrat?
If you could say that he's a highly effective authoritarian. For some people, if you ask Russian civil society members, they would absolutely have no problems calling him a dictator. Other people would say, well, we need to have a more refined definition than that. But what you can't call him is a Democrat.
My guest on WNYC is William Dobson. His new book, The Dictator's Learning Curve, Inside the Global Battle for Democracy. Anybody with questions or comments about 21st century dictatorships, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And maybe relevant to Putin, I noticed that you spent some time working for Fareed Zakaria, known from CNN and Newsweek, and he talks about illiberal democracies, which was the title of one of his books. Is that what you're talking about with some of these new style dictatorships?
Yes, that's an apt description for many of them. I mean, I think one of the points that I would really try to stress, though, is that these regimes are not the result of sort of abstract forces coming into play. This isn't, I really resist the idea that once you get to a certain level of economic development, for example, that necessarily means that a regime will go one way or the other. What I found in going to all these places and interviewing people that work for these regimes is that there's actually a very conscious man-made project at work. I mean, there's a very deliberate approach to creating the architecture of one of these regimes, because there has to be. I mean, if you think about it in just our own lives, in all ways, the forces of modernity are really sort of leveling centralization. It's really hard to centralize anything, which is really the key component of a dictatorship or authoritarian system. And so if you're going to sort of buffet yourself against those forces, you have to create something that is flexible and durable and can be reinforced. And that's very much what is the case. These are not accidents. These are people working around the clock.
You write about technology, and one of your conclusions seems to be that social media and other technology are good for pro-democracy movements, as we've heard a lot about, but also powerful weapons for dictators.
That's absolutely true. I mean, I think that technology in some ways is a neutral factor. It's really a question of who uses it better. There's no question. I mean, when I would walk through Cairo, the graffiti is Facebook. I mean, that's literally what people were writing on the walls. There's no question that people there were able to use it very effectively. I mean, a very good example before Mubarak fell was really one of the ways that a youth group there used it early on. And what they did is they wanted to sort of get their message out, and so they attached it to a labor group that was going to go on strike. And they basically just put up a Facebook message saying, hey, everybody on this particular day in support of these workers, strike. And the group grew exponentially. It grew so fast. And the regime had never seen anything like this before. And so what did it do? It responded by putting bulletins up on the television news every night saying, on that day, do not go on a strike. Well, they fell for the trap, because these youth could never have broadcast their message as effectively as the regime ultimately did. And so everyday Egyptians, seeing that on their television, said, wait a minute, why are you telling me I have to go to work on that day? I choose not to go to work on that day for just that reason. And so you can use technology in these ways to sort of unexpectedly trip up a regime. And that's what they did so well.
Bob in Rego Park, you're on WNYC. Hi, Bob.
Yeah, how you doing, Brian? Continue to do a great job. My question is this, the gentleman is speaking intelligently. He's not mentioning all these dictatorships in all these countries exist because of the military. Could he talk a little about the existence of the militaries in these countries that maintain these individual dictators?
Good question.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a very good question. I mean, the role of the military in these different in these different regimes, it varies, actually. In some, I mean, there's really, among the ones that I travel to, there was really none where the military was as paramount as in Egypt. I mean, it's hard to put a perfect label on what Mubarak's regime was, but in truth, the most accurate would really be a military dictatorship, because the military ran through the entire political system. So you had a president, you had elections, so to speak, you had branches of government and whatnot, but the military was the backbone of that regime. And so that's why I'm so concerned about events in Egypt, because although we still refer to it as a revolution, and the events there are incredible and important, the military was also one of the most likely future leaders of the regime. And so in a sense, you could argue that what happened in Tahrir Square wasn't so much a revolution as it was succession. And now we see that, in fact, one of the former heads of the Air Force is one of the most likely next presidential leaders of the country, just like all modern Egyptian presidents have been members of the military. In other places, the civil-military relations are not as intertwined. In the case of China, the military's role is crucial, but the military has been kept in check by the Communist Party. The Communist Party is, without question, the supreme institution. In case of Venezuela, Chavez has very effectively politicized the military, so that the top people in the Venezuelan military are really part of his political project, too. So it's a pillar of these states. How it interacts with the rest of the state varies.
How do you see Syria, which is probably the dictatorship that the world is most frustrated by right now, with an ongoing slaughter, I guess it's fair to say, of Syrian people by the government or forces loyal to the government, and the inability of the international community seemingly to do anything about it?
Right. I mean, Syria is an abject example of what happens when a dictatorship is cornered and lashes out in a very 20th century sort of way. I mean, this is in no way a state exhibiting modern, sophisticated tactics. This is a wounded animal that's flailing desperately. I personally think that the days of the regime are numbered. That doesn't necessarily mean this month, this summer, this year, but I think that it's isolated itself so thoroughly that it will be impossible for this regime to rebound in a way that we've seen so many others be able to do. Now, in terms of, the scene there itself, I mean, essentially you have a minority government. Really, it's the Alawite, government that is fending itself off from all these rising forces. I think those forces are going to continue to rise. It's going to become harder and harder for the regime. It's going to be stretched thinner and thinner. So I really think that the future outlook for that regime is a very desperate one.
My guest, William Dobson, he's the politics and foreign affairs editor at Slate, and his new book is The Dictator's Learning Curve, Inside the Global Battle for Democracy. Your book not only devotes space to the dictators themselves, but also to pro-democracy activists in many of the countries. And you write about networks. In fact, I should mention that there's a slideshow up at Slate today featuring several specific activists around the world. It sounds like there's a Serbian group that's had a broad impact and that they share with each other across borders these days, huh?
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, I had to spend time in all these countries meeting the pro-democracy forces. Otherwise, I would have plunge into a deep depression, I think, at some point. These were the bravest, most incredible people I've ever met in my life, just bar none. And in all the countries I visited, I would spend time with these people. And the Serbian group in particular, it was an incredible story in their own right. This was a group, it's called Canvas. They were members of the Serbian youth movement that toppled Slobodan Milosevic in 2000. And one of the leaders of that movement, a man named Serge Popovic, found himself 28 years old, and he had already succeeded in toppling his country's dictator. He went into Serbian politics for a little while, but he found that he didn't really have a taste for it. And so after a couple of years, he asked himself, so what is it that I know how to do? And he understands how to challenge authoritarian regimes. And so he set up an organization which now goes around the world training people on how best to combat their own authoritarians, their own dictators. And so in the last 9 years or so, they've worked with groups in more than 50 countries.
And you cite Gene Sharp, the legendary organizer who is for Gandhi and Martin Luther King style nonviolent activism. He was on the show recently. But he doesn't say nonviolence out of a commitment to being nice, but because those are the tools available to most people in the world without getting slaughtered by their dictators.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, it's funny, these young Serbs weren't aware of Gene Sharp's work. They became aware of it eventually. They actually got some training of their own from someone who had studied with Gene Sharp. But they were coming to this, and I found this again and again, Russians, Venezuelans, Egyptians, who were actually, you would have thought they were experts in Professor Sharp's ideas, but they weren't. In some cases, they were. Some people had studied his ideas, but some of it was intuitive for them. And then when they come across his ideas, it really hones and refines their own thinking. And you're exactly right. I mean, I witnessed this members of this organization, the Serbian organization, talking to Egyptian youth leaders. This is all during the Mubarak days, where the Egyptians would come to him and say, look, we want to run our organization like it's a democracy, because we figure if we want a democracy, our groups running against Mubarak should be operating like a mini-democracy, a microcosm. And the Serbs said, no, that's absolutely wrong. You have to be much more strategic. If you run your little civil society organizations like a democracy, they'll be infiltrated by the regime in no time at all. And that, indeed, was the Egyptians' experience. And so they said, no, you've got to run it like a military. There's only a few people at top, and they make the decisions. You never have all your leaders in the same room, all sorts of different really practical, granular pieces of advice they could give them. They went back, and that particular Egyptian youth organization, April 6th, completely reoriented how it went about its work. And I'm not saying that they're responsible entirely for bringing down Mubarak, but they were one of the key groups that mobilized people to go to the square.
Fascinating. So one more thing. How important do you think the international justice system is for deterring dictators? We had the 50-year sentence for former Liberian dictator Charles Taylor just the other day. Does that chill the dictators of the world? I mean, officially it was for crimes that affected another country, not his own people. But is there still some precedent there?
Yeah, and that's a really fascinating question, which I think a lot of people in the academic community have been debating for a while. People I know in the legal community have been debating. You know, if you were one of these people, what would you do? Would you lash out and go and opt for violence sooner? Well, it didn't necessarily work for some of them either. Perhaps your best option is to catch the next flight to Saudi Arabia, which harbors a number of former dictators. I, through a friend, spoke to one former member of Mubarak's regime who actually lamented this after the revolution. And he pointed to Libya, and he pointed to Yemen, and he, you know, pointed to Syria and said, look how they're dealing with it. We should have done that. Well, you know, in the case of Yemen, their president is no longer there. In the case of Gaddafi, he was hunted down by his own people in a drainage pipe. We may find that Assad's future isn't nearly so bright either.
So is dictatorship on the run in the 21st century?
My basic feeling about it is these are incredibly flawed regimes. I mean, at root, they don't make sense. These are anachronisms. So I'm very optimistic, and I grew more optimistic as I wrote the book. But at the end of the day, what are they trying to do? They're perpetuating their rule, and they're quite effective at perpetuating it. So if they're here for 30 years, 40 years, 50 years, well, in the long run, we're all dead. So that doesn't do me much good. I think that their reality, we can see in a place like Russia or Venezuela, a democratic system something that was democratic, however briefly, swing back towards authoritarianism. This is a pendulum. This isn't something where we can move them in one column or another. Mm-hmm. It's a continuing process. I'm optimistic at root, but it's not easy work.
William Dobson's new book is The Dictator's Learning Curve, Inside the Global Battle for Democracy. Fascinating. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, Harvard sociologist Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot, author of a book called Exit, The Endings That Set Us Free. How do we leave one thing well to move on to the next? And she wonders, do we shortchange goodbyes to start anew? Stay tuned.